single coverage, right side, end zone, touchdown!
It's time to go inside the X's and O's of what just happened in the NFL.
Back to pass from his goal line, steps up, he's hit, he's going down in the end zone!
This is Hardcore Football, powered by J&M Remodel, the Seattle home remodeling experts. Go to jnmremodel.com.
He throws back in the end zone, caught, touchdown, advantage, big fella!
Hardcore Football is on. With Hugh Millen, here's the Infernus.
Before we bring Hugh on, just a real quick note, since we came on the air just a few minutes ago, Seahawks made some roster moves. They signed Damon Snacks Harrison to the active roster. Remember, he was called up from the practice squad. He's now on the 53-man active roster. Greg Olsen goes to injured reserve. Also going to the injured reserve, running back Bo Scarborough. Hardly knew you, Bo.
What a bummer.
Had 31 yards before leaving with a hamstring injury. And Stephon Sullivan, who played one game, week 8 against the Niners, as they still list him here as a tight end. Remember, he played defensive end in that game. He also goes to the IR. Hawks also signed Brad Lundblade to the practice squad. He is a center out of Oklahoma State who was undrafted in 2018. He's been with a number of teams. DeMarcus Acy also signed to the practice squad. So they get a center in the building. At least, depending on what happens with the guys.
I've had my eyes on Lundblade for a long time, Ian.
Everybody has. Hugh Millen joined us now, Hardcore Football. Hello, sir. How are you?
Good afternoon, guys. I'm well. Thanks for asking.
Hey, let me actually just start for I'm throwing you a little curveball here on this because they brought the center in. Damian Lewis starts at center last Thursday, and by all accounts, his first ever start at center, and I heard the term at any level, Hugh. Like going and flipping from left tackle to right tackle can be hard enough because you're punching with a left hand, right hand, and your footwork, and you know. But you can do that. Guard, same thing. There's things to have a guy play center for the first time in his life in an NFL game. How remarkable, stunned, difficult. What was Hugh Millen's thoughts, and what are the challenges that he would have had to undergo?
Yeah, not knowing how much he practiced center at LSU and prior to that, I would just say on the surface of it, very stunned. I'm surprised. In some sense, I'm surprised they would even ask him to do it, that they wouldn't have a better plan than that. He, as a rookie, of course, had been playing really well as a right guard, probably more so in the run blocking, the pass blocking, but I think he's having a really good season all the way around. And, you know, to ask him to drop in, I'm sure he did not want to do that.
No.
But I think that, you know, you have contingencies. Like, think of the contingency you have for from the starter to the backup at quarterback. Okay, obviously, Russell's a lot better than Geno Smith, but at least you feel like you have a solid contingency. The gap from 2 to 3, though, you know, what's going on after that? You know, if you only have 2 quarterbacks active, you know, who's going to be quarterback? I couldn't even tell you. Tyler Lockett? I mean, who's their emergency quarterback?
I don't even know.
If two guys were to get hurt. So I think that center is a little bit like that. You know, obviously kickers, punters, there's some way you say, well, we can handle one injury, but we can't handle the next injury. And, you know, even go back to the Super Bowl when Seattle played the Steelers. They could handle the injury to Kenny Hamlin. But then it was Marquand Manuel they couldn't handle, right? Because then dropped.
Then you go down to 3. Yeah.
Then you always go down to three, and you could make an argument that that was the reason why they lost that football game, because in the top 4 or 5 most pivotal plays of the game, the third string safety was central in the breakdown.
Well, I mean, I go back the playoff game against Dallas in Dallas. What was it, 2 years ago now? I think it was 2 years ago, and when Janikowski's 75-year-old hamstring blew up on that kick at the end of the half.
Yeah.
And he comes out, you know, in street clothes in the second half. And I remember watching, sitting in the press box watching Michael Dixon attempt to kick field goals or extra points for the first time in his life. And Hugh, you could go to a Pop Warner field and find a guy that would hit more than he hit. I mean, I counted he was 0 for 11 at one point. And so they had no kicker, which changed everything they had. I mean, it turns into like a high school game, right? If you don't have a kicker and everything, you're going for fourth down and everything.
Going for 2 and
And that, if you look back at the game book in that game, it affected how they had to play that game. But the center position, We always hear about guys calling the line calls and everything else. Can you explain what exact? I mean, you know, you see a guy pointing, he sits up before he snaps and everything, pointing here, pointing there. How much of what Damian Lewis had to do would be new to him, or as a guard, is he still familiar with the line calls?
Well, he's familiar with the line calls and the expectation, but the burden of having to distinguish, you're going to generally call out the mic if the protection is oriented towards the mic. You say, okay, the line has the mic.
Okay.
So you have Mike, Will, Sam. Mike, you say, well, why do you have those? Those are names of males, right? Mm-hmm. And well, Mike is for middle linebacker, Sam is for strong side, and Will is for weak side. It's just the first letter, right? And so forename, is that what they call it? I was thinking it's not surname, obviously it's forename, whatever. But they're male names, and so you want to call out the mic because in a protection you say, okay, the line has the mic. So as a quarterback, as the running back, and so then you say, well, the running back has the Will. All right. And then the quarterback would say, well, I'm hot off of the Sam. If the Sam linebacker comes or anybody to the strong side, I'm just giving you kind of a general, but you know, it branches off from here, but this would be a typical way you'd say, okay, the line has the mic, the back has the Will. And then you're hot if the Sam comes. Well, you can redirect. And you can say, okay, the Sam is the mic based on whether or not the safeties are backed up. Like, let's say you look and say, well, the Will is not going to rush because the safety, there's no safety backing up. Let's say you got a slot receiver and the Will's walked out. He could be threatening to blitz and what have you, but you know he's not going to blitz because there's no safety that would be in coverage of that slot receiver. So you can eliminate, you say, okay, that's just window dressing. The Will's not going to block. How about this? I'm going to, instead of having the actual mic, like let's say you're going against the Seahawks defense. I understand you're talking about the Seahawks offense.
No, but that's good. That's a good illustration. Go. Yeah.
Yeah. So you'd say 54 is mic. Mm-hmm. 54 is mic. And then, you know, well, KJ's now the Sam. So, you could then turn and say, well, I want to make it so I don't think that that Brooks is coming off the weak side, or let's say Ugo Amadi, let's say he's the nickel Will, and there's no safety backing him up. Well, Ugo Amadi's not blitzing because they can't be sound and bring. So now we'd say it's not 54 is Mike. Let's say 50 is Mike. Mm-hmm. So now the line says they have KJ right. The running back who would have had Ugo Amadi,
he gets the Will,
he now has Bobby Wagner.
Gotcha.
And so now that's how you look and say, well, we think there's more of a credible threat on the strong side. Let's redirect and we'll name a new mic. We can name the mic whoever we want.
Right.
Because in that protection, everybody knows that the line has the mic. Now they can sort that out depending on their open gap. You know where the bubble is, meaning who's covered and who's uncovered. But somehow or another, they're going to sort that out, and the line is going to get the mic. And we can make the mic whoever we want. You know, similarly, we could do it the other way. You know,
that's a lot to process for someone who's never done it before.
Yes.
And, oh, by the way, you're going to do it on Thursday Night Football. In your 11th NFL game you've ever played or whatever the hell it is, right? I mean, that's just, I think just him stepping in, they ran Hugh for 123 yards and 5.85 yards per carry for the running backs. I'm taking Wilson's numbers out of that. So as we're running, you know, 21 for 123 and 5.85. With a guy that had never played center before. I mean, and let me jump into there real quick, because did you see anything different? And I'm taking Wilson's numbers out of it because I don't think any of those were designed runs, if I'm not mistaken. But did you see anything different with Carlos Hyde and to a certain extent of Bo Scarborough in there in that running game?
I did with Carlos Hyde. And what I saw was that, to my eye, I think that he is in the same league as DJ Dallas in terms of physical skill set. I think that he said, okay, you know, how quick are they, how fast are they? Those are, of course, two different elements. How strong are they? I think that physically they're similar. I think they're the similar size. I think they have similar speed. They have similar burst. They have similar lateral quickness. Remember now, DJ Dallas was a punt returner for the Miami Hurricanes, right? Yeah. So, you know, he's an open field type guy, but he's got some strength to him. So I don't think there's a huge discernible difference between them physically. What I saw from Carlos Hyde was that his vision was a lot better than DJ Dallas. One can infer it's because he's a veteran and he understands things, and what it comes down to is understanding of the front. And you know, for example, there was a play where the Seahawks had a gap scheme. That's where the front side is going to block down towards the center, towards the ball, mm-hmm. as opposed to stepping away like you have in a zone scheme. And then by blocking, it was going to be, you know, a power to the left. It's generally power, but counter is a gap scheme as well. So when you hear those terms, those are generally gap schemes. Okay, so the down blocking again. So if you're going to go power left, you're going to down block with the line on the left side, and then you're going to pull the backside guard. And right at the snap of the ball, the Arizona, they went into a reduction where they pulled the end down in tight on the right side. So instead of Carlos Hyde running to the left at the point of attack, he just immediately hit the cutback lane. If you drew it up on a whiteboard, that ball was supposed to go in the B gap, and you count A, B, C from inside out. So the B gap would be to the left, would be between the left guard and the left tackle. That ball was supposed to go to the B gap, but he took it to the backside C gap on the backside of the tackle.
On the right side?
On the right side.
Wow.
And he did that immediately. Now, I just described a gap scheme play, and I won't be tedious and design all the zone schemes that he did the same thing, but he was getting a lot of yards at points that were not the point of attack. And
is that just recognition on his part then?
Yeah. Yeah. It's recognition
and vision. It's recognition and vision. Yeah. Are recognition and vision the same thing with a running back?
Yeah. I mean, I'd have to think that through.
Synonymous.
But well, as I'm thinking, I have to distinguish to you, Ian, the difference in my own mind when you talk about recognition pre-snap and post-snap.
Right.
And we probably think of running backs as, okay, we're going to react to how the defense flows, and the vision is going to be, where's the hole developing?
Gotcha.
And, you know, for example, when I played with Emmitt Smith, and that was during a time when Barry Sanders was deemed to be the top running back in the league, and there were some football people that you know, it was always Emmitt or Barry Sanders, and most fans would tell you Barry Sanders, of course, right? Well, in that room, it was Troy Aikman, Jason Garrett, Norv Turner, and myself. And in the running portion of practice, what's called 9-on-7, there'd be a high-angle camera from behind the play, and this would all be running plays. And Norv would say, okay, what hole do you think Emmett's going to go through? And Troy might say, well, I think he's going to go to the strong B gap. And, you know, Jason might say, well, I think he's going to bounce it out to the D gap on strong side. And maybe I'd say, oh, I think he's going to cut it back to the weak side A gap. And the purpose for us doing this in this quarterback meeting was really Norv was marveling at Emmett's vision and sense of how the play is going to develop. And Emmett would just get the ball and he would just bend to the right area. And as I said, it might be anywhere in any one of the gaps, but he would just kind of bend. Now, bend is not a sexy way to describe an elite halfback. When you think of Barry Sanders, he's thinking the jukes and the, you know, make your jockstrap fall down and all this stuff. And you know, you don't describe, you wouldn't think of in your mind's eye, close your eyes and say, yeah, Barry Sanders used to bend to the right area. But that's what Emmett did. He had this sense, and people always used to say, well, Emmett has X number of yards before he's even touched that great Dallas line. Well, that was absolutely true. They had a great line. But it was also Emmett making those guys because he had a sense of just where to bend the ball. And so he had this amazing vision and this sense of seeing the movie before it played out. He knew what what seemed to hit, and he would just kind of curve to the right area, and so he made that line look really good. Now, for Carlos Hyde, getting back to Carlos Hyde versus maybe a DJ Dallas or whomever, I'll tell another story that I think reflects on the situation. When I was with the Broncos, Alex Gibbs was the offensive line coach, the famed architect of the outside zone, and Terrell Davis was the running back, you know, rushing for 2,000 yards. I saw all that. I was in those meetings. In fact, I handed Terrell Davis his first NFL rush attempt. The way Alex would coach, and I'd never really seen this to this extent, Alex would coach the Terrell Davis, say, look, in this front, you're going to have the backside cutback. Trust me. And then he'd say, in this front, you're going to hit at the front side. And he would tell him, he'd just say, look, if you understand the fronts, you're going to know before the ball's even snapped where you're going to go with the ball. Mm-hmm. And I'm not in the head of Carlos Hyde, and I'm not in those meetings, but I think we can infer this. If we watch a game and we say, Carlos Hyde is hitting holes that are not the point of attack holes, and he's doing it with more efficiency than a rookie, I don't think we're out on our skis to say that that's the difference between a veteran and a rookie at running back. He's able not only post-snap, to have a sense of where the defense is flowing and go to the open area. Part of that is the key that he gets pre-snap based on the front and the knowledge of the gap responsibilities and the run fit responsibility, gap for the defensive lineman, run fits for the linebackers and safeties. And if he has an awareness of this and he's watching defenses disguise and what have you, and he knows what's window dressing and what's substance, right? Because a lot of that stuff is just, you know, it's all just bluff, right? But it's having that experience and that knowledge of what ultimately the defense is going to be in and what their gap responsibilities are, and know who's got a tough block, who's got an easy block, and where the opportunity is going to flow. But I would say I should go back and actually track it. But as I watched Carlos Hyde, it seemed like every single big run he had, I know where that point of attack is supposed to be when you draw it up on the whiteboard, right? Which gap you're supposed to hit. He wasn't hitting in that gap. And you know, the term has been said, hey, you know, forgive me, but this is football parlance. So you're going to bang it at the hole, you're going to bounce it to the outside, or you're going to bend it back on a cutback on the weak side. You know, those are in essence the three things you can do. Now, there's more details within those, particularly, you know, on the cutbacks. You know, when are you cutting back? Are you cutting back after you get to the defensive line? Are you cutting back behind the line of scrimmage? Which he was doing a number of times, but he was hitting more cutbacks than he was banging at the prescribed hole or bouncing. Now, bouncing, when you talk about bounce, there's only a handful of guys in the league that really have the green light to bounce. And what I understand what I mean by bounce is, let's say the play is described to go over the B gap on the left side, as I said, between the guard and the tackle. If he senses that the edge collapses and that there's an opportunity to go wide left, that's again the play was supposed to go to the left, but he wants to take it wider. In this league, well, I'll go back to what Alex Gibbs used to say: "This ain't bounce university." You know, like he just said, if you're gonna bounce that play, you better be right, because you're going lateral. You're going lateral. You're going parallel to the line of scrimmage, and you weigh 100 pounds. I mean, think about it. Effectively, your ability to fight through any tackle when you're running to the sideline, a guy could pursue inside out. He's a little bit faster than you, or let's say he had a step, and so you might be faster than him, that linebacker, but he already had a step. He was already a yard and a half closer to the sideline, so he can run you down. Plus, if it's just a straight race and you're trying to bounce it and you're 2 yards behind the line of scrimmage, let's say he has the equal starting point and he's dead equally as fast as you, he's still going to win because you've got to be faster than him to gain yards. You got me? He can run you out of bounds, and it's a loss of one, and you say, well, that was a dead heat tie in the race. No, you got to be faster than that linebacker to get positive yards. So a lot of line coaches are really reluctant to, and running back coaches are reluctant to give that green light to bounce. You better have some serious speed or some great instincts if you're going to bounce the ball. And so we didn't see that from Hyde. We saw him cutting back.
Well, and I love that. I think that's a great explanation of what you get with a veteran running back. And not to say that at some point Dallas can't get to that point either with some more experience along the way, but a big ask for a guy coming out of college. All right, take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll talk quickly about the defense the Seahawks played and how different that was in the first go round with the Arizona Cardinals and what to look ahead for with, say, Philadelphia next week. Hugh Millen, Hardcore Football continues.
Now back to Hardcore Football, powered by J&M Remodel, the Seattle home remodeling experts. Go to jnmremodel.com on your home for the 12th man and the NFL. Sports Radio 950, KJR.
Hardcore Football continues. Hugh Millen. Hugh, last time the Seahawks played the Cardinals, they did not, and I mean this in a literal sense, they did not touch Kyler Murray. No sacks, no quarterback hits, no pressures, nothing. Not a thing. This time around, last Thursday, and I kind of use this almost looking ahead as the season goes on, 3 sacks and 7 quarterback hits along the way. Obviously it's a different team. Jamal Adams didn't play in that first game. Carlos Dunlap didn't play in that first game. Was it strictly personnel? It never is. You got a better eye than that. What did you see from that defense?
Well, they just were a lot more multiple. I think that I can't remember a time when the Seahawks showed more in terms of their fronts, in terms of their coverages, their disguises, the blitzes. They did zone blitz. They played 2 deep. They played 3 deep. They played man. They brought edge pressure. They took out that toolbox and they opened up, you know, every single shelf in the toolbox. And one of the things that I find interesting is their use. Well, I'll talk specifically about KJ Wright. Now, he was a box defender in week 7, 40% of the time, down a little bit to 28%. But I think that he's an interesting study with this defense because he lines up on the line more, as I just suggested. Mm-hmm. And so he's got in the run, if the run comes at him, he's got to hold the edge. But they're asking him also to be a buzz defender and then get out in his zone. Typically that's tough on a guy to have the flat zone and try and get out underneath deep curls and deep comebacks by wide receivers and have that emanate from the line of scrimmage position. But that's what they're asking him to do. We know that's not what they wanted to do because in week 1, he was only on the defensive line 1 time. Week 2, only 1 time. Then against the Cardinals, he was on the defensive line 37 times.
Holy cow.
So they've really changed from what they planned in training camp, you know, and obviously in part because of Bruce Irvin and that injury. But that's tough duty. Now, what they're getting out of it is interesting. And the reason why I say it's tough duty is because he's part of a 5-down alignment. So you've got on the one side, you've got Carlos Dunlap and just think of it. It's like a 5 guy. So Carlos Dunlap and KJ Wright on either side. Mm-hmm. And then in the middle, they're actually fortifying. There's a lot of beef in there in the middle because you're generally going to have Puna Ford as the nose tackle. And then you have LJ Collier and Jaren Reed. And that's almost like 2, 3, 4 defensive ends, you know, like big defensive ends, but not really pass rushers. And so when KJ Wright backs off and is part of a 7-man zone or man combination zone and they rush the standard 4, let me repeat it again, what standard is to rush 4, when KJ is running out of there, then Jaron Reed is the guy that lines up to KJ's side most of the time, and Jaron Reed then has contain on a quarterback. So he lines up in the B gap between the guard and the tackle, but his responsibility is to make sure that the quarterback doesn't get outside the C gap. So he's looping around with that contained responsibility, and that's hard for him to make an impact from that position. So the whole interconnect between what they want to do to stop the run and what they want to do to stop the pass, I don't think is ideal. I think the reason why they were successful is that they just showed so much to make Kyler Murray have to think and process. Mm-hmm. And the other part of it is that is how they rushed the passer. And I know we're up against it, so I'll just close with this note. The way they rushed the passer, you didn't have a bunch of guys. Now, occasionally Puna Ford was the exception. But for the most part, these guys, they weren't trying to get into gaps and really like sell out to be the individual who got to Kyler Murray. They were, as a team, just trying to squeeze the pocket, push the pocket back, more like two gap. In terms of just saying square up on the offensive lineman and just try and walk the lineman back and be in a position that if Murray were to scramble, that each of these guys, I'm talking about Reed and I'm talking about Collier and I'm talking about even the defensive ends,
Dunlap.
Dunlap and KJ on the few occasions he would rush. Dunlap, those guys would be cautious not to sell out into one individual gap, just squeeze the pocket on a guy, you know, 5'10", and that was far more effective. So more blitzing, although still not a heavy diet of blitz, much more a variation. And then a very careful approach to squeezing the pocket as opposed to trying to get into gaps against a very athletic quarterback, as twitchy a quarterback as I've ever seen in my life at the pro level.
And we've talked before about if you're a quarterback and you're not 6'3 or 6'4, sometimes you get squeezed like that, hard to see. And I think we saw that in the passing game as well.
Absolutely, that was a factor.
Hugh, you're the best, man. I will check in with you next week. Have a great
No, Greg Cosell's the best, but I'll take it. All right, enjoy.
Have a great Thanksgiving. There you go, Hugh Millen. We'll head down to Salt Lake. Is BYU really trying to duck UW? We'll find out next.